International Edition. Coming up, the Russian foreign minister speaks out about his troops near Ukraine. A closer look at the use of explosive weapons in Syria.
People are just acknowledging the impact on civilians with barely a shrug.
A shooter goes on the rampage at a U.S. military base. And we go on a visit to the Sonoran Desert. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says troops near the Ukrainian border will return to their permanent bases as soon as they finish military exercises. Ukrainian officials have said as many as 100,000 Russian soldiers along its eastern and southern borders are poised to invade. NATO's top commander, General Filip Breedlove, said Wednesday the Russian force is ready to go and could take over large parts of Ukraine in as little as 3 days. Foreign Minister Lavrov today called on the West and Ukraine to de-escalate the rhetoric, which he says is becoming unreasonable. Meanwhile, International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde said Wednesday that as the world struggles to emerge from the 2008 financial crisis, economies are under threat from tensions involving Ukraine and Russia's annexation of Crimea.
Our hope for the program for Ukraine to work, and I'm looking, you know, with my narrow lenses of economic and financial stability, is that geopolitical tensions go away, come down, so that that country and its people can actually recover.
Return to the Soviet Union has been the buzz phrase for an emboldened Russia under President Vladimir Putin since the start of the Crimean crisis. VOA's Michael Eccles in Moscow has this look at the issue.
History professor Andrei Zubov was fired from the Moscow State Institute for Foreign Relations for a newspaper article comparing Russian President Vladimir Putin's actions in Ukraine to Adolf Hitler's Anschluss. He gave two reasons for writing it. Zubov said he wanted to see how far Russia had come from the Soviet era. He wrote the article as a message and an experiment. Zubov's dismissal and the recent crackdown on press independence, TV Rain, and Lenta.ru demonstrates tightening control over dissent, reminiscent of Soviet times. But according to Masha Lipman of the Carnegie Center, there are crucial differences with contemporary Russia, especially lack of ideology.
Socialist, communist, however you call it, but there was a clear set of ideas, of formula, of tenets that was radically different from those of the West.
The West, however, remains the primary antagonist. The Russian parliament is pushing criminal legislation to mandate the disclosure of dual citizenship. Mr. Putin had a few comments. He said Russians have the right to know who's living in their country and what they're up to, and that dual citizens must be kept track of. Zubov has a simple explanation for the government's reliance on old paradigms. The middle and older generations are used to thinking in the Soviet fashion and are not accustomed to new ideas, he said. Aimed primarily at Ukrainian-Russian dual citizens, the Carnegie Center's Lipman additionally sees this as a turn away from the international Soviet identity.
The developments in the Crimea are pushing him and Russia in general towards something that is that looks increasingly nativist.
A move toward ethnic nationalist policy could be dangerous for a Russia just as diverse as its predecessor. Meanwhile, old methods remain at the ready for new ideas in development. Michael Eccles, Voice of America, Moscow, Russia.
The International Committee of the Red Cross warns the humanitarian crisis in the Central African Republic will get worse without major efforts to restore security in the lawless country. A senior ICRC official says the lack of security keeps the population in a state of perpetual fear. Lisa Schlein reports from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
The International Committee of the Red Cross says the people of Central African Republic are held hostage to pillaging, killings, and sexual violence meted out by the warring factions. The ICRC head of operations for Central and Southern Africa, Patrick Lott, has just returned from a four-day visit to the country. He tells VOA, people live in a state of constant danger. Survival is their only mode of existence.
What's going on now between communities is very difficult and puts the people in a very difficult situation. The fear for their life, they are put under a lot of pressure during the day, but also during the night. And this takes place in a country which was already before the events in a state of extreme poverty.
Lott says this pervasive fear affects every aspect of society and hampers the ability to provide humanitarian aid. He says local health workers are under enormous pressure during the day while treating the sick and wounded.
But they also experience a difficult situation in their private life during the night when they are with their family, fearing for their life or for their belongings, and sometimes forced to flee their home on a very short notice.
The Red Cross was present in the country before this current war broke out at the end of 2012. This made it easy for the agency to move smoothly from a traditional to an emergency operation as the crisis grew. The agency's main focus is on the health sector. It has three surgical teams working around the clock at the community hospital in the capital, Bangui. It says around 70% of those receiving emergency care are victims of shootings or stabbings. The ICRC also provides medical care in other parts of the country, such as the town of Kagabandoro and in Indele in the north. But operations head Lott says the Red Cross's traditional role as neutral mediator between warring parties is difficult to perform in the CAR.
You don't have two well-defined groups fighting against each other. You have a combination of different factions, groups, and criminality also is rising up in the present days, so it has a real effect on the deterioration of the situation.
Lott says impunity in the country is widespread. He says that people feel they can do whatever they want and will not have to pay a price for their actions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Two decades have passed since hundreds of thousands of people were killed in the Rwanda genocide, and Western powers were accused of standing by and allowing it to happen. As VOA's Kent Klein reports, experts say there are lessons to be learned on how to prevent such tragedies in the future.
The world was shocked when an estimated 800,000 Rwandans were massacred in about 100 days, starting April 7, 1994. Members of the ethnic Hutu majority killed about 70% of the minority Tutsis living in Rwanda and many moderate Hutus. U.S. President Bill Clinton was criticized at home and abroad for doing nothing to stop the slaughter. 4 years later, he visited Rwanda and apologized for his inaction.
We did not act quickly enough after the killing began. But all over the world, there were people like me sitting in offices day after day after day who did not fully appreciate the depth and the speed with which you were being engulfed by this unimaginable terror.
Despite the vow of never again, the catastrophe in Rwanda did not bring the end of widespread violence against civilians. Genocide in Sudan's Darfur region and sectarian violence in the Central African Republic are among the acts of mass brutality since then that have left millions dead or homeless. In the Syrian civil war, at least 150,000 people are believed to have been killed, and another U.S. president has been accused of inaction. Amnesty International's Adote Akwe says opposition from Russia in the United Nations Security Council is blocking White House efforts to stop the violence in Syria.
The international community has to end the crisis in Syria somehow, and the administration has been consistent in trying to do that, but it's not been able to actually achieve the results that we all want to see.
Veteran U.S. diplomat Johnny Carson, now a senior advisor at the U.S. Institute for Peace, says the Rwanda genocide taught the world it has to move quickly.
Act swiftly, and to muster the resources of the international community to condemn and engage as quickly as possible when we see an atrocity about to occur.
Ambassador Carson says the lessons of Rwanda and other massacres led President Barack Obama to establish an Atrocities Prevention Board,
which is an interagency group that gets together once a month under the direction of the National Security Council to review situations around the world that may be likely to turn into atrocities or mass violence.
Akwae says the board is a major step forward, but efforts to prevent atrocities must start sooner.
It would be better and probably more economical to try to challenge intolerance and hate propaganda earlier on, before all of the actors are in place, when things are actually beginning to threaten people.
Akwae says the best way to prevent genocide is to show that the world is watching and will not tolerate it. Kent Klein, VOA News, Washington.
The Syrian conflict has claimed more than 100,000 lives, forced millions of people to leave their homes, and reduced cities to rubble, according to Action on Armed Violence. AOAV works to reduce and hopefully prevent the impact of conflicts around the world. And lately, they have been taking a closer look at Syria, where they report explosive weapons have shaped the dynamics of the fighting. Robert Perkins is their senior weapons researcher.
It's 3 years pretty much to the week that the conflict first started. In 2011, there was a series of protests which the Syrian government responded to with the actual use of explosive weapons quite early on, which was unusual. It's not very common for a government to deploy such heavy weapons that aren't really used for domestic law enforcement among its own people. And that rapidly escalated into a series of increasingly violent face-offs and standoffs. And everybody knows the story of how the conflict developed over the next 2 years. The use of explosive weapons steadily escalated. And in February 2012, we saw the first situation where they were used in a wholesale sense in a populated area in the city of Homs, when there was steady bombardment throughout February 2012, and it killed more than 640 civilians. And that was a turning point from which we haven't really looked back. And 3 years down the line, this conflict has continued to develop at the cost of more than 100,000 lives, many of whom are civilians.
Are we seeing the use of these weapons on both sides now?
Oh, very much so, yes. It's by no means just the regime who are using explosive weapons, and heavy explosive weapons at that. At first, it wasn't the case, but for well over a year, that's definitely been the case, that all parties are using explosive weapons.
What is exactly an explosive weapon? If you could describe some of them for us.
Oh, absolutely. It's a good question, because it's not a category of weapons that is easy to understand first off. But they're anything that affects an area with blast and fragmentation effects. So it includes things like airdrop bombs and the barrel bombs that we've been seeing recently are an example of those. It includes things like rockets, mortars, and artillery shells. And it also includes the improvised bomb, which has caused a wide number of casualties in Syria and elsewhere. All of these weapons share the same central characteristic of not being able to limit their effects to one single person, which is why they've been such a problem and why they've been the driver of the crisis in Syria.
How would you compare this problem in Syria to other conflicts in the world?
The use of explosive weapons in Syria is much more intensive than anywhere else in the world at the moment. Although we've seen examples in recent years, you know, 2006 in the Gaza Strip and 2008 in Sri Lanka, for example, also in Afghanistan and Iraq, they're widely used. My organization, Action on Armed Violence, records casualties from explosive weapons around the world from English language media sources. And last year, and also in 2012, both years, we recorded a casualty from an explosive weapon in 58 different countries. So they're widely used weapons, but in Syria, it's more intense than anywhere else in the world, just by our data alone. And as an indication of that, 89% of the casualties that we've recorded from explosive weapons in Syria were civilians, unarmed people, innocent people. That has been dramatically much, much higher than the rest of the world, even though it's high there too. In the rest of the world, not including Syria, that percentage drops to 75%. So that's just kind of one example of how significant the use is there.
Aren't these weapons very expensive?
Yeah, I suppose they are. Syria had an extremely well-stocked arsenal of these weapons before the conflict started. They had one of the biggest stockpiles of weapons and of platforms to use them in the Middle East and in North Africa, basically anywhere in the world, actually. And they've been built up over a long period of time. What's important to note is that a lot of these weapons are not new, flash, smart weapons. They are weapons that date back to the 60s and 70s in many cases, and they were mostly bought from the Soviet Union. So they've been built up over a very long period of time. And they're being used, as I said earlier, by both the regime and the opposition. A lot of the weapons that the opposition are sourcing are coming directly from the regime's stockpiles, either stockpiles that have been raided or weapons that have been seized during the course of combat. And they're also being made by rebels and opposition forces themselves. So both sides are now using makeshift DIY weapons to supplement their existing arsenals.
Well, what can we learn? What lessons can we learn from this situation in Syria?
There's a lot that can be learned, and there's a lot that needs to be done both in Syria and elsewhere. And we need to do everything we can to prevent another situation like this emerging. My organization is part of something called the International Network on Explosive Weapons. And we believe that it's paramount important that states begin to challenge and explore their own practices around the use of these weapons. It's for far, far too long. It's been just accepted as part of the norm that explosive weapons, weapons that affect an area, can be used in places where civilians are gathered, and that the casualties that result from that are simply unfortunate collateral damage. And this has been seen in Syria just 3 years down the line. People approach this conflict with a sense of great fatigue, even here where we are never, it's never unshocking what's happening in Syria. But even here, people are just acknowledging the impact on civilians with barely a shrug. And that has to stop. We're not calling for a ban on these weapons because we recognize that will probably never happen. But we are calling for states to take on their own practices and raise the threshold of acceptability around their use in places where civilians can be affected.
Robert Perkins, a senior weapons researcher with Action on Armed Violence and author of their report, Syria, 3 years in, a country torn apart by explosive violence. A U.S. soldier has killed three of his fellow military personnel at the Fort Hood Army Base in central Texas before committing suicide in an incident that also left 16 other people wounded. Dispatcher put out the word.
We have an active shooter on Fort Hood. We have multiple gunshot victims. We also have some people that are escaping through windows.
The base commander, Lieutenant General Mark Milley, said the motive was not known, but that authorities did not believe it was related to terrorism. Authorities identified the gunman as Ivan Lopez. Milley said the shooter spent 4 months in combat in Iraq in 2011 and was in the process of being tested for post-traumatic stress disorder. President Obama was traveling in the city of Chicago, Illinois, when he learned of the shooting.
We're heartbroken that something like this might have happened again. And I don't want to comment on the facts until I know exactly what has happened. But for now, I would just hope that everybody across the country is keeping the families and the community of Fort Hood in our thoughts and in our prayers. The folks there have sacrificed so much on behalf of our freedom. Many of the people there have been through multiple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. They serve with valor and they serve with distinction. And when they're at their home base, they need to feel safe.
Fort Hood was the scene of a mass shooting spree in 2009. 13 people were killed and more than 30 others wounded when an Army psychiatrist opened fire on personnel. Dr. Matthew David is the trauma director at the Scott and White Memorial Hospital in Temple, Texas, where some of the victims of Wednesday's shooting are being treated. He spoke today with NBC Television's Matt Lauer.
The weapon used in this shooting, Dr. David, was a .45 caliber semi-automatic handgun. Can you describe, without going into too much detail, the types of wounds you're dealing with?
Sure. So this is obviously a fairly high-velocity weapon and can inflict a fairly large amount of damage upon patients. And we saw that evident last night. The wounds, some patients were fairly lucky in that they were fairly superficial, involving extremities or maybe just a graze injury. Others happened to be some shrapnel injuries that were from bullet impacts on structures that were nearby the patient. And then we did have some very serious injuries to the neck, chest, and abdomen as well.
This isn't the first time this has happened at Fort Hood. I believe you even treated some of the victims of the shooting back in 2009. Again, the shooter is a member of the military. As a doctor, how do you even begin to get your arms around this situation?
You know, it's difficult for us to understand why something like this would happen. Obviously, our heart breaks for our friends over at Fort Hood. We have close ties with them. We work with them closely in the community as well as in a healthcare setting. It's really difficult to understand why these acts of madness occur. Clearly, we think highly of Fort Hood. There are tens of thousands of soldiers that rotate through there, and there are tens of thousands who call that home. And so I don't think this is an indictment of Fort Hood itself based on the acts of madness from two individuals, but it certainly is concerning, especially for those of us that are close to the military and their family.
Dr. Matthew David at the Scott and White Memorial Hospital speaking with NBC Today Show host Matt Lauer. Deserts are generally known as large expanses of land with such dry weather they're hostile to life. Some deserts are actually lush, however, with plants and animals that thrive in dry conditions. One of the world's most intriguing is the Sonoran Desert, which spans the southwest U.S. and northwestern Mexico. From Tucson, Arizona, Shelley Schlender takes us there.
As drivers speed down the highways across the vast Sonoran Desert, the only life they see often seems to be giant saguaro cacti, standing alone and silent as sentinels. But at the Sonora Desert Museum, life is everywhere, including on this blustery, scrub-covered bluff, where a museum volunteer uses a loudspeaker to tell a large crowd about one of the most extraordinary birds of prey exhibitions in the U.S. A volunteer trainer raises his arm to send a raptor into the air.
This is a beautiful female red-tailed hawk.
The hawk swoops so close, her wings nearly brush people's heads. To bring her back to his leather-gloved hand, the trainer holds up a strip of meat. Up next, a peregrine falcon. As a grand finale, the trainers give wing to an entire family of russet-feathered Harris hawks. The hawks soar across the valley, then perch on tall saguaro cacti. When their trainers call them in, they suddenly go off script.
Oh, wow, look at that.
They dive into the sagebrush and make a kill.
This is a good example of a group hunt. They were all sitting here.
More tranquil moments await visitors who stroll the museum's 3 kilometers of outdoor paths, past yellow desert daisies, pink globe mallow, grasses with blue blossoms, prickly cactus, and 60,000 other plants. All have evolved to thrive throughout the Sonoran Desert on hardly any precipitation. A good example, says museum horticulturalist John Weens, is this desert ironwood tree.
It can go through incredible droughts and die back clear to the ground and re-sprout new trunks from the ground time and time again.
He says there's a reason this world-class zoo is also a botanical garden.
We have a lot of different plants from our region here with interpretation to let them know that animals don't stand alone in nature and neither do plants. It's all interrelated, interlinked.
Interlinked in another desert ecosystem, a green Arizona parrot perches on desert scrub oak. It's not far from a steep cliff with a pond at the bottom and a cave far away at the top. In that cave is a man-sized mountain lion.
Are there mountain lions in this area?
There are tons of them.
Really?
Continuing on the path, visitors reach the backside of that cave where they discover not a cave wall, but a picture window, behind which is the mountain lion watching them.
Skylar, isn't he cute? Don't you want a kitty like that?
A mother and her preschool son lean forward.
He's a big little guy.
He's a cutie, huh? But you don't ever pet those if you see them in your backyard.
Other exhibits let visitors get up close to more than 200 native desert animals that slither, creep, and fly.
His tail, it makes rattles. And you don't go near that sound because he's warning you that you're getting too close and he'll bite you. He's got fangs in his mouth. You see him?
He has a tongue too.
Yeah, he's got a tongue. A long tongue.
Spider. 8 legs.
So this is the desert blonde spider.
On the nest, there's a hummingbird right there on the nest. He's looking at me.
The museum's marketing director, Rosemary Prodzik, says these native animals in their natural settings are popular.
We're ranked the number 9 museum in the world.
And that's based on our ratings on TripAdvisor by people who visit. So it's people like you and me who come and experience it and realize that this place is really a gem.
The museum also leads major conservation efforts throughout the Sonoran Desert region, all part of fulfilling its mission to inspire people to live in harmony with the natural world. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender near Tucson, Arizona.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On April 3, 1860, a temporary mail service was inaugurated to span the gap in the telegraph line across the American West. The Pony Express was a relay of riders and horses that, in about 10 days, could cover the 2,700-kilometer distance between St. Joseph, Missouri and Sacramento, California. In 1882, American outlaw, robber, and murderer Jesse James was killed by fellow gangster Robert Ford. After his death, Jesse James became one of the legendary figures of the American Wild West. In 1922, Joseph Stalin was appointed General Secretary of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. Stalin was dictator of the Soviet Union from the mid-1920s until his death in 1953. He led the Soviets to victory over Nazi Germany, but his cruel regime caused the death and suffering of tens of millions of people. On this day in 1942, the Japanese army staged a major offensive against Allied troops in Bataan, the peninsula around Manila Bay in the Philippines. The all-out assault would result 6 days later in the surrender of the largest number of U.S. troops in military history. In 1948, President Harry Truman signed the European Recovery Program into law, better known as the Marshall Plan, after the man who proposed it, Secretary of State George Marshall. The legislation provided billions of dollars in aid for the devastated countries in Europe after World War II. In 1975, world chess champion Bobby Fischer refused to accept the format of a series of chess matches against Anatoly Karpov, thus resigning his title to the Russian master. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Acting Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Azra Zeya, at the release of the 2013 Human Rights Report, said, "We continue to call on the government of Vietnam at the highest levels to make progress to comply with its international human rights obligations and commitment. And we've made clear that doing so will allow us to further the bilateral relationship." According to the report in Vietnam, the most significant human rights problems continue to be severe government restrictions on citizens' political rights, particularly their right to change their government, increased measures to limit citizens' civil liberties, corruption in the judicial system and police, and limit of freedom of speech and press. The Human Rights Report also highlighted positive developments. In 2013, a lively public debate about lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights took place throughout Vietnam. While the U.S. government continues to call on the Vietnamese government to allow all Vietnamese citizens to exercise their right to freedom of religion, this year's report noted that the Vietnamese government registered 115 Protestant church congregations, a significant increase compared to previous years. Additionally, the government of Vietnam signed the UN Convention Against Torture in 2013 and recently granted amnesty to prisoners of conscience Nguyen Hu Cao and Dinh Dang Dinh. "I'm truly inspired by the civil society activists that I've met with in many of the countries I've been to, in Hanoi, for instance. People who are standing up for their fundamental right to speak out and to associate freely," said Secretary Kerry. "Some of the greatest accomplishments in expanding the cause of human rights have come not because of legislative decree or judicial fiat, but through the courageous act of individuals."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.